Imagine for a second, right, that you are sitting in a darkened movie theater.
Oh, yeah. Best feeling in the world.
It really is. The lights have just gone down,
Yeah.
and there's that, you know, that heavy, expectant hush that falls over the crowd.
Right.
And then, boom, a Vudio logo flashes across the massive screen. Now, while you're in that headspace, I want you to picture the three most recognizable, heavily discussed American film directors of the last 30 years.
Okay. We're talking about the heavy hitters here.
The absolute heavy hitters. We were talking about Quentin Tarantino, David Fincher, and Christopher Nolan.
Right. Guys whose names alone are enough to sell tickets.
Exactly. But if you really stop to think about it, what actually binds them together? Because on the surface, you've got the king of blood-soaked, rapid-fire dialogue,
Right, Tarantino.
then the absolute master of the moody, cynical procedural.
Session, sure.
Yeah. And finally, the architect of these massive, mind-bending sci-fi spectacles with Nolan. I mean, they seem incredibly different.
They do, yeah. Worlds apart, aesthetically.
Right. But they actually share this hidden cinematic DNA. And today, we are diving deep into our sources to decode how these three specific masters manipulate, challenge, and ultimately control you, the audience.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the very first connection between them is not about art.
No, it's
It's
not.
not about camera angles or writing or anything like that. It's about something entirely different.
It really is. What's fascinating here is that the foundation of their shared identity isn't aesthetic at all. It's completely structural.
Structural, right.
Yeah, and that structural fact essentially comes down to one single word, money.
Money. Which, I mean, that feels almost counterintuitive, right? Especially when we're talking about auteurs.
How so?
Well, because auteurs, meaning, directors who exercise such an extreme level of creative control that they're viewed as the absolute singular authors of their movies, we usually think of them as starving artists.
Right, the romantic ideal of the struggling visionary.
Exactly. We don't usually think of them as financial moguls. True, but money is the ultimate reality of filmmaking. I mean, if you want to paint a masterpiece, you just need a canvas and some oils, right?
Yeah, practically costs nothing.
But if you want to make a movie, especially a big movie, you need millions of dollars. And the profound reality here is that Tarantino, Fincher, and Nolan are really the only modern directors who figured out how to make deeply personal, highly idiosyncratic films, but, and this is the key, at a massive blockbuster scale.
Wow, yeah, that scale is huge.
Right. To really understand the mechanics of why that matters, we have to look back at the generation right before them. Think about Steven Spielberg and Martin Scorsese.
Okay, two absolute titans of the industry.
Unquestionably. But they operated in completely different ways regarding power. I mean, Spielberg was essentially the studio system perfected.
Right, he was the golden boy.
Exactly. He understood exactly what the executives wanted, that broad four-quadrant appeal, and he made that system work for him flawlessly.
He gave them blockbusters. They gave him whatever he wanted.
Precisely. Now, Scorsese, on the other hand, fought the studio system his entire life.
Oh, constantly.
Yeah, he was always battling executives to get his gritty, uncompromising personal visions onto the screen. It was a struggle. Then along come our three directors in the 1990s, and they somehow almost miraculously crack the code.
Yeah, they figured out how to get that massive studio executive money without the executive interference.
Exactly.
It's kind of like, well, think of an indie band, right? It's like an indie band using major label money to build the biggest, loudest stadium speakers in the world, just so they can force 80,000 people to listen to a 12-minute experimental jazz solo.
That's a perfect analogy.
Right, because they completely hijacked the big machine for their own personal art.
That is exactly the mechanism at play, because by generating massive box office returns really early in their careers, I mean, think about the cultural explosions of Pulp Fiction, Say Seven, or
Oh,
Memento.
massive hits. Game changers.
Right. So by doing that, they built this undeniable leverage, and they used that leverage to buy themselves the ultimate currency in Hollywood, which is total control.
Total control.
Yeah, they are all complete control freaks, and they use highly specific tactics to maintain that fortress around their art.
And the tactics they share are actually staggering when you lay them all out. Like, first, they all still insist on shooting on actual celluloid film.
Which is so rare now.
It is. In a digital world where studios love the cheapness of hard drives, they demand actual film. And second, they have this shared, almost religious obsession with the theatrical experience.
Oh,
They
totally.
want you in a seat, in the dark, away from your phone.
Huh.
Third, they write or co-write their own material.
Keeping the vision pure from page to screen.
Exactly. And fourth, and honestly, this might be the most powerful one, they work with the exact same crews for years on end.
That last point is absolutely crucial for maintaining power. Because by keeping their cinematographers, their editors, their production designers completely identical for decades, they essentially create a loyal micro studio. And that micro studio answers only to them, not the executives. So if a studio executive tries to interfere, they aren't just fighting a single director.
They're fighting a whole team.
Exactly. They're fighting a highly calibrated hive mind that has worked together for 15 years. It creates this impenetrable wall. They really are the last of a very particular kind of American director.
Wow.
And frankly, looking at the industry today, we really don't know who is coming next to claim the specific level of control and scale.
That is a wild thought. But, and this is where it gets really interesting,
mm.
total financial control doesn't just buy you the best cameras or immunity from studio notes.
Right.
It buys you the freedom to indulge your deepest psychological obsessions.
Oh, absolutely.
And for these three, those obsessions went in wildly different directions. The source material has this brilliant framework for understanding this. It basically argues that Tarantino owns language, Fincher owns surface, and Nolan owns time.
It's a very neat, clean, aesthetic division. Language, surface, and time.
It is neat, but wait, I actually have to challenge that a bit.
Oh, really? Go for it.
Because calling Tarantino the language guy just feels kind of wrong to me.
I mean, the dialogue is iconic.
Yes, the dialogue is famous, obviously. But when I think of Kill Bill, I don't think of the dialogue first. I think of that blinding yellow tracksuit against a snow-covered garden.
That is a striking image.
Right. Or think about his signature trunk shot, you know, where the camera is literally inside a car trunk looking up at the actors.
Okay, yeah, the classic low angle.
Exactly. Or even his incredibly deliberate product placement of fake brands like the Red Apple cigarettes. He is a profoundly visual filmmaker. It's just that his dialogue is so loud and flashy that kind of tricks us into ignoring his visual mastery.
That's a really great observation, and it forces us to refine this framework a bit. You're right, Tarantino isn't just a typewriter. His visuals are completely essential. But let's shift to Fincher for a second.
Okay, the surface guy.
Right. The original idea was that Fincher owns surface and perhaps distrusts language because he's so obsessed with visual mood. But that's not quite right either. Fincher doesn't distrust language. He uses it as a highly calibrated weapon.
A weapon?
Yeah, look at The Social Network.
Oh, right, which actually shifts the dynamic entirely because that's an Aaron Sorkin script.
Exactly.
It's wall-to-wall dialogue.
It is. But Fincher is the director who took Sorkin's script and forced the actors to talk at that blistering, almost unrealistic speed.
They talk so fast in that movie.
They do. Mm. And by speeding it up, he made the dialogue act almost like a percussion instrument. It creates this incredible claustrophobic anxiety for the viewer. So he treats language with absolute surgical precision.
Wow, okay.
And speaking of his mastery of surface and sound, think about the rowing scene in that same movie.
Oh, man. I know exactly the scene you mean. It's visually immaculate with these muscular rowers just gliding across the water at Henley.
Exactly. And what does he score it to? Trent Reznor's electronic cover of In the Hall of the Mountain King.
Which is such a bizarre but brilliant choice.
Completely. And why does he do it? Because that combination of elite old world money and aggressive mechanical synthesizer music creates an incredible thematic tension.
Right.
Fincher uses language, he uses music, he uses imagery, but he never lets one element randomly run away with the film. Every single choice is a calculated weapon designed to make you feel a specific type of unease.
That makes a lot of sense. But wait, if Fincher uses language as a weapon, where does that leave Nolan? Because honestly, half the time I can't even hear what his characters are saying.
Yeah, that is the common critique. Nolan often treats language as exposition that simply has to be survived. Our sources call it the price of admission.
The price of admission. That makes perfect sense. Because you don't really go to a Christopher Nolan movie to quote the lines.
Right. You go for the massive structural puzzle.
Yeah. The puzzles and the mind-bending spectacle. I mean, think about Bane and The Dark Knight Rises.
Oh, perfect example.
Half the audience literally could not understand what the man was saying through that mask.
It was completely muffled.
It really was. And Nolan didn't seem to care because the dialogue was secondary to the sheer terrifying physical scale of the character.
He certainly gets a bad rap for his sound mixing choices, but we do have to defend his underlying writing capabilities here.
Fair enough.
Because when Nolan actually wants to write a real, deeply human scene, He can absolutely do it. Look at the nuanced, devastating conversations in Oppenheimer.
Oh, totally. The script for Oppenheimer was incredible.
Or the sharp, obsessive rivalries in The Prestige. The language there is compelling and absolutely essential. So it's not that he can't write. It's just that his primary obsession is the manipulation of structure and time. Dialogue just isn't the main event for him.
Okay, so we have these three distinct obsessions. We've got Tarantino's visceral style, Fincher's surgical precision, and Nolan's structural time puzzles.
Yeah.
And this leads to the most fascinating realization of all, because these obsessions directly dictate how each director views the person sitting in the dark theater.
It dictates how they view you.
Exactly, how they view you.
This is really the core of their different approaches. They hold three completely different theories of the audience.
Okay, so as I walk through these, I want you listening to really consider which of these experiences you actually prefer. Let's start with Tarantino.
Got it, Tarantino.
Our source is called Tarantino the Populist. He believes that you, the audience, are hungry.
Hungry for what?
Well, he thinks cinema belongs in the back of the house, in the cheap seats, and his job is to feed you. He's serving up these huge, indulgent portions of spectacle, snappy dialogue, iconic music, and buckets of blood. His ultimate goal for you is ecstasy.
Ecstasy. It's a deeply visceral relationship.
Absolutely.
He wants you reacting outwardly, laughing, gasping, cheering at the screen. He wants the theater to feel alive.
Right. Then you have Fincher, the magician. Fincher believes that you are suspicious.
Suspicious? Interesting.
Yeah. He looks at the modern audience and thinks, they live in a post-truth world. They have seen everything, and they are completely jaded.
Which, I mean, he's not entirely wrong.
He's not. So he is working a skeptical room. He believes you need to be actively tricked or manipulated into feeling something real. So his goal isn't ecstasy. His goal is diagnosis.
Diagnosis.
Yeah. He wants to peel back the surface and show you a dark truth about the world or maybe even about yourself.
He's testing the audience. Yeah. He never lets you get comfortable. He wants you leaving the theater feeling slightly paranoid.
Exactly. And finally, we have Nolan, the architect. Or, you know, maybe you can even call him the teacher.
The teacher.
Nolan believes that you are intelligent. He's actually the most flattering of the three because he treats the audience like they are sitting in an advanced graduate seminar.
He really does.
He trusts that you can keep up with complex timelines, mm-hmm. inverted entropy, quantum physics, all of it.
Though sometimes he pushes it a bit far.
Well, yeah. You know, sometimes he thinks you're intelligent.
Yeah.
But also need a little hand-holding like in Tenet.
Oh, Tenet.
Yeah, a movie so temporally complex that the protagonist essentially has to stop and explain the time inversion plot to the audience four separate times.
Sure.
But his underlying goal is always comprehension.
It's a fundamental respect for your cognitive ability. He wants you to solve the puzzle with him, and understanding this synthesis is crucial. We shouldn't try to pick one correct theory of the audience because a healthy cinematic ecosystem requires all three of these appetites to be fed.
But what happens if we don't have all three? What if we just lean into one of them?
Well, think about the extremes. Mm. If cinema only aims for ecstasy feeding the hungry audience like Tarantino, we end up with 100 years of nothing but light action, blockbusters, comedies, and musicals.
Which is fun. But
right. It's incredibly fun, but it never asks the harder questions or challenges our morals. On the other hand, if we only have Diagnosis Fincher's skeptical room, we get a relentless cinema of pure pessimism.
Oh, that would be exhausting.
It becomes way too dark, too cynical, and it completely fails to offer any hope or release. And if we only have Comprehension Nolan's graduate seminar, we just get TED Talks at IMAX scale.
TED Talks at IMAX scale. That paints such a clear picture.
It's intellectually stimulating, but it lacks a human pulse. We need the populist, the magician, and the architect pushing against each other to keep the art form vital.
All right, so if these are their distinct goals, ecstasy, diagnosis, and comprehension, which individual film actually achieves its director's mission best? How do we measure their masterpieces?
That's the big question.
The sources outline a brilliant way to evaluate this by breaking it down into three criteria: perfection, weight, and seriousness.
It's honestly the best way to evaluate art because it admits that a masterpiece means different things depending on the specific mechanism you value.
Right. So let's start with the argument for Tarantino's masterpiece, Pulp Fiction.
Classic.
It undeniably wins on cultural weight. I mean, it was a cultural earthquake that completely changed the way movies sounded, how timelines could be fractured, and how soundtracks were integrated into storytelling.
It was everywhere.
It was. But the argument against it being a structurally perfect film is its complete lack of artistic discipline. I mean, think about the entire middle section of that movie.
You mean the Bruce Willis part?
Yeah, the whole sequence with Bruce Willis, the gold watch, and the pawn shop.
Right, which takes up roughly 40 minutes of runtime.
Right. And technically speaking, from a strict screenwriting perspective, it is almost entirely unnecessary to the forward momentum of the primary Hitman storyline.
It really is a massive detour.
It diverges wildly.
Yeah.
But because Tarantino is the populist, whose goal is ecstasy, his desire to feed the audience with style and wild situations overrides traditional pacing. So it's a heavy, massive film, but it's deeply indulgent.
Which brings us to the polar opposite, Fincher's masterpiece, Zodiac.
Oh, Zodiac.
This film lends on moral seriousness. There is absolutely zero indulgence here. It is 2.5 hours of watching a cartoonist and a reporter slowly lose their marriages, their careers, and their sanity to an unanswered question.
It is so bleak.
It is, and the genius mechanism of Zodiac is its deliberate refusal to provide catharsis.
And by catharsis, you mean that neat, tidy feeling of relief we usually get at the end of a mystery when the killer is finally caught and punished.
Exactly. Fincher completely denies you that. Years pass in the film, leads go cold, and the tension just rots away into quiet despair.
Yes. You really feel the time passing.
You do. Every single exhausting scene is necessary to build that oppressive weight. He is working that skeptical room, diagnosing the destructive nature of obsession itself. He doesn't want you to feel good. He wants you to feel the agonizing passage of time.
Wow. And then we have the absolute champion of structural perfection, Nolan's Memento.
Ah, Memento.
This is arguably the most perfect, tightly wound object the three of them have ever produced. It has absolutely no fat.
None.
By telling the story in reverse chronological order, Nolan forces you to experience the exact same short-term memory loss as the protagonist.
It's brilliant.
It has the tight discipline of a brilliant short story. And we have to mention, it also features a severely underrated, incredibly grounded performance by Guy Pearce.
Oh, Guy Pearce is fantastic in that. The mechanism of Memento is a flawless puzzle box. Every single piece fits.
And it culminates in a final line, which is really the chronological beginning of the story, if you think about it.
Yeah.
That completely recontextualizes every single thing you just spent 2 hours trying to understand.
It pulls the rug right out from under you.
It does. So, to the person listening right now, when you declare a movie your favorite, what are you actually valuing? Do you value the undeniable, messy cultural impact of something like Pulp Fiction, the heavy, lingering moral challenge of Zodiac, or the structurally perfect, flawless puzzle of Memento?
It reveals a tremendous amount about how your own brain processes storytelling.
It really does. Now, having established their unique masterworks, it's time to move to the ultimate ruthless thought experiment from our source text.
The Cruel Game.
It's a cruel game, but it clarifies everything we've talked about so far. The question is this. If you had to lose one of these directors from history, if one of their slots in the culture goes completely dark, never to be filled by them, who do you cut? And whose specific magic could realistically be replaced by someone else?
It is a brutal question, honestly. But it forces us to define what makes an artist truly singular. Let's look at the argument for losing Nolan first.
Okay, why Nolan?
This perspective is what they call the working filmmaker's position. It argues that Nolan's massive scale and structural intelligence can actually be replicated by others. We have incredibly brilliant, technically proficient directors working today who handle massive budgets with extreme intelligence.
Like Denis Villeneuve directing the Dune movie.
Exactly. Villeneuve brings massive, highly intelligent sci-fi to the screen. Or Alfonso Cuarón directing Gravity. They are doing versions of intelligent, massive-scale cinema. The argument here is that while Nolan is brilliant, if he vanished, his slot in the industry wouldn't remain completely empty.
Someone else would step up.
Right. Someone else would build the giant puzzles. However, the voices of Tarantino and Fincher are described as irreplaceable, one-of-a-kind fingerprints.
But wait, then there's the counter-argument that you should actually lose Tarantino.
Let's hear it.
And the logic here is fascinating. It argues that Tarantino has essentially already won. Yeah, his influence on the culture has been so absolute that we have already absorbed him into our collective bloodstream. I mean, think about every snappy prestige television show on the air right now. Mm-hmm. They have all absorbed his pacing and his rhythm.
That's true. You hear it everywhere.
Every screenwriter under the age of 50 has spent their formative years trying to mimic his dialogue.
So it's like, it's the difference between an inventor whose patent has expired and become public domain versus someone who is still holding the only key to their machine.
Exactly. If Quentin Tarantino stopped making movies tomorrow, his fingerprint is already permanently baked into everything we watch. Whereas Fincher and Nolan are still doing load-bearing, work-inventing techniques that haven't been fully digested or easily replicated by the rest of the industry yet.
That makes a lot of sense. Which brings us to the final, wildest perspective. The argument for losing Fincher. How do you possibly justify losing The Magician?
Have you?
Well, the justification rests on the idea that Fincher's worldview and his aesthetic are the easiest of the three to actually teach and replicate in a film school.
Really? Teach Fincher?
Yeah. The mechanical elements of a Fincher film, the incredibly cold, detached camera movements, that signature sick, jaundiced green color palette, the intense procedural rigor where characters literally just look through file boxes for 10 minutes. Those are techniques that can be borrowed.
Okay, I see.
Other filmmakers can study Zodiac or CS7 and approximate that exact vibe.
I get it. Because if you try to copy Tarantino's voice, you just sound like a cheap, embarrassing imitation trying way too hard to be cool.
Exactly. It always sounds fake.
And Nolan's specific brand of massive original sci-fi. You simply cannot convince a studio executive to hand over $200 million for a reverse entropy spy movie unless the name Christopher Nolan is stamped on the cover.
They'd never fund it.
Never. Therefore, Fincher's mode is the most replaceable because it's the most teachable.
Precisely. It's three completely different lenses on what makes a director essential.
Man, that is a tough debate. But, you know, the beautiful thing about this cruel game is the realization that comes at the very end of it. We shouldn't lose any of them.
Not a single one.
The fact that you can make a rock-solid, compelling argument to keep each one of them proves how absolutely vital they all are. So what does this all mean?
It means we need balance.
Exactly. Our cultural ecosystem is incredibly fragile, and a healthy one requires all these different forces pushing and pulling against each other. We need the populace throwing blood and music at the back row to keep us entertained.
We absolutely do.
We need The Magician keeping us paranoid, sharp, and skeptical of the surface. And we need the architect building these massive, intricate puzzles for us to solve together.
They are three load-bearing pillars holding up the modern theatrical experience. And if you remove even one of them, the entire structure becomes incredibly unstable.
It's been an absolute blast digging through all of this. I mean, understanding the underlying mechanics of how these directors view us totally changes the way you watch their films.
It really does. And before we finish, I actually want to leave you with a completely different thought to carry with you.
Oh.
We've spent all this time dissecting the masters who defined the last 30 years of cinema, but their era of total unchecked control might be closing.
Right. Like we said earlier, who knows what comes next?
Exactly. So the next time you sit down in a dark theater or queue up a movie on your couch to watch a debut film by a brand new up-and-coming director, ask yourself, are you being fed, are you being tested, or are you being taught?
Oh, that's good.
And are they inventing a completely new cinematic language for the future, or are they just speaking fluent Tarantino, Fincher, or Nolan? Because the real question isn't who we can afford to lose. It's who is going to be the bold new architect for the next generation, and more importantly, which of those do you secretly want the most?
Such a fantastic question to end on. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep asking questions, keep looking closer at the art you consume, and we will catch you next time.